So it's my pleasure to introduce Daniel MacArthur, who is from just down the street and has been instrumental in creating an extremely valuable resource that, based on the title of his talk, I think he's going to tell us about and probably how it's changing the world. So, great.
Cool. Thank you, Jennifer. And thanks for the opportunity to be here today. It's a great pleasure to be here, of course. So as Jennifer mentioned, I work just down the road at the Broad Institute. I have a lab that also spends a fair bit of time over at Mass General Hospital. We have two focuses. One is on rare disease diagnosis, which you've heard a lot about and I'm not going to talk about today. And the second, as Jennifer mentioned, is thinking about ways in which we can build up very large collections of genetic variation from the general population, primarily with the focus of using these as reference databases to understand what variants do and which ones are most important for causation of rare disease. And I think I wanted to start with generally framing a sense of why I'm so excited about human genetics as we stand right now. I think it's actually, you know, the most exciting field that's going on at the moment, and it's the most exciting time to be working in human genetics. And that's because human genetics provides us with a way of moving back and forth between two very different and powerful kinds of information. So we are becoming increasingly good, as you've heard from other speakers today, at layering information across the genome. So here in this random screenshot from the UCSC genome browser, we have some chunk of the genome, and for each base in the human genome, we have information about whether if that's present in a gene or not, if so, where that gene is actually expressed, if it's in a non-coding region, whether that is also a regulatory region that may play some role in regulating gene expression. And this information is increasing thanks to information like ENCODE and Epigenomics Roadmap and GTEx and other resources. And then another type of information that we as the broader biomedical community have become very good at collecting is information about human phenotypes. We now have millions of people around the world who have been collected in large, often national scale biobanks. And these people have a whole variety of different bits of information collected about them. And these can range from information about particular diseases they've been diagnosed with, which may be stored in, you know, more or less well-formatted fashion. There's all sorts of electronic medical record data, prescription registers, quantitative trait data and questionnaires, in many cases, a whole bunch of interesting and rich biological or functional genomic data like transcriptomics or metabolomics that can give us some insight into the biology of those individuals. And human genetics is cool in part because it provides us with a way of moving back and forth between these two kinds of information. So the traditional Ford genetics way of doing human genetics is that we would collect people on the basis of phenotype. So do something like what Gil just talked about, identify a set of families who have some interesting and very rare disease, group those people and then see what pieces of DNA they have in common, that is what variation they have in common, and use that to zoom in on particular genes that may underlie their disease. This has been an incredibly productive approach. We now know more than 4,000 genes associated with Mendelian diseases and many thousands of regions in the genome that are associated with common complex disorders like type 2 diabetes, for instance. But as we start to build up these big biobanks and we start to sequence, that is, do DNA sequencing on more of the people in those biobanks, it becomes feasible to start thinking about moving in the opposite direction as well. That is to find people and group them on the basis of their genotype. So find, for instance, all the people who have particular disruptive mutations in a particular gene, group them on that basis, and then look to see what they have in common in terms of their traits. This is what we would call reverse genetics. It's a very common approach to doing things in model organisms where we can actually genetically engineer particular mice to lack a specific gene, for instance, and then see what happens to them when we knock that gene out. Now, of course, in humans, we can't do genetic engineering, but what we can do is take advantage of the enormous amount of genetic variation that exists in the general population. And the amount of variation that exists is genuinely staggering. You can calculate actually relatively easily based on what we know about the distribution of mutation rates across the genome and how many people exist, that given that effectively any given single nucleotide substitution, that is at a particular position in the genome, a change into an A or a C or a G, almost certainly exists out there among the 7 billion people that exist in the population. So that means humanity, in effect, represents an enormous natural experiment where we have tried, certainly not the complete space of human genomic sequence, but perturbations across many different regions of the genome. And all we need to do to understand exactly what effect each of those perturbations have is sequence the genomes of all 7 billion people on the face of the planet, hook those into a big electronic medical record system that allows us to go back and recontact people based on that information, and then systematically collect, for instance, all the knockouts in a particular gene and see what they have in common. Now, we are not, as you guys know, anywhere close to being able to sequence 7 billion genomes yet, although that will happen eventually. But what we can do is to start to accumulate information that has been collected across now well over 2 million people who've had either their whole genome sequenced or in many cases their exomes, that is a particular technology that allows us to look just at the protein coding bits of the genome. So this 2 million number is a lower sort of ballpark estimate. These 2 million people have been sequenced through a whole host of different academic and commercial ventures, and they've been generated in, this information has been generated in sites around the world, collected for a whole variety of different projects. But just to give you an idea about how fast that information is growing, curves like this, I'm sure, have been presented earlier today. But this is information just from one place, the Broad Institute, again, a couple of blocks down the road. You can see here the growth in the number of genomes that have been sequenced from 2009 to 2016. This information is about, I guess, about 8 months, 10 months out of date. Over here, we have the number of exomes sequenced. And the two bits of information you should be taking from these curves is firstly the number at the top, which tells us we had, at the end of last year, sequenced about 70,000 genomes and over 250,000 human exomes. It's a staggering amount of data, but also the shape of this curve. In 2016, we sequenced more genomes than in all years previously combined. And so the trajectory at which we are generating these data is truly staggering. Now, ideally what we want to do is to take all these 2 million sequenced individuals and house them all together in one big unified biobank that would allow us to link between genotype and phenotype. But this turns out to be very difficult for all sorts of reasons. There's mundane obstacles associated with moving data from one place to another. It turns out that because these samples have been collected over many decades, often well before they were sequenced, the consent that they were consented under is often inadequate to justify very large-scale data sharing. And in fact, a lot of my life is dealing with inadequate consent and data use permissions. There are objections to data sharing. So much of this data has been generated in an industry setting, and that is often regarded as a trade secret. You guys, I'm sure, will be shocked to learn there are even some academics that are not fully on board with the idea of sharing data. So this can be challenging. And then a final problem that we face is the fact that different centers who generate this data tend to process and perform variant calling across that data in idiosyncratic ways. So if we were to just take the outputs of each of these different centers and try to merge together this matrix of 2 million sets of genotypes, we would end up with a variant call set that was dominated by technical differences between centers as opposed to interesting biological differences between people, which of course is not useful. So to resolve at least some of these problems, we have been working, I guess, for about the last 4 years on building up large reference databases of human variation, leveraging the expertise and the data that exists at the Broad. So when we started this exercise back in 2012, there were two large public data sets of human variation. We had the 1,000 Genomes Project, which contained about 2,500 low coverage whole human genomes from a variety of different populations. It's a fantastic project. We also had the NHLBI's Exome Sequencing Project, which had generated exome sequencing from about 6,500 individuals of European or African American descent. And so to cut a very long story short, we began analyzing rare disease patients using these resources and rapidly found that they were too small and in many cases too old to be good comparison data sets for our rare disease patients. So we built over a relatively painful 18-month period our first large call set of human exomes. This is called the Exome Aggregation Consortium, or EXAC, data set that was released back in 2014. And that contained information from just over 60,000 human exomes. And then almost to the day, 2 years later, in October last year, we released an updated version of EXAC. This is now called the Genome Aggregation Database, or NOMAD, because we like slightly curious and idiosyncratically capitalized names. And this now contains about twice the number of human exomes. And for the first time in NOMAD, we've also included a whole collection of human genomes, so providing information about the distribution of variation across the non-coding, that is the non-protein coding bits of the genome. So it's important to note that we did not sequence these samples. These data all come from various studies, and I'll list the PIs and where these samples come from in a minute. From many different studies, we aggregate that data, and we put it through the same processing pipeline, and then we do what's called joint variant calling across all samples simultaneously, more or less. And that allows us to get a harmonized call set across these large numbers of samples. And this is a testament to the engineering and scaling work that's been done at the Broad Institute. So this is a brief summary of the pipeline. I'm not going to go through the details about how our variant calling pipeline works. I don't think it's hugely relevant for this audience. I guess it is worth emphasizing on this slide, you know, we start with raw data. We go through an individual sample variant genotyping, variant calling approach. We then do joint genotyping across large numbers of samples. There's a variant recalibration approach, and then we have this final call set, this very big variant call file or VCF file that stores all the data across these samples. So the thing I did want to mention, though, is that this is a lot of data. So the raw data that's gone into this project over the exome data, which is on the left-hand side, and the genome data on the right-hand side is about 3 petabytes of raw sequence data. And that condenses down to about a 40 terabyte variant call file, which is actually still a staggeringly large file that we have to work with. many people were involved in generating and analyzing these data, and I wanted to particularly call out the Broad Data Sciences platform for building the tools that allowed us to call variants of this scale, but also, incredibly importantly, a toolkit called the Hale system, which was built at the Broad Institute. I don't know, Alex here in the room is a representative of the Hale team, and Hale was absolutely critical in being able to go from this 40 terabyte VCF and actually do important things with it, like quality control and assess the variants and release data in a useful way to the public. And a huge thanks to all the members of the team who contributed to this as well. So it's worth emphasizing who's actually ended up in these databases. So we have this roughly, you know, over 135,000 people across the exomes and the genomes who are in the NOMAD database. These people are not necessarily well. They come primarily from case control studies of relatively common complex adult onset diseases. The big hitters in terms of the major diseases included in the database are type 2 diabetes, early onset myocardial infarction or heart attack, and neuropsychiatric conditions like schizophrenia and bipolar. So about half the people are controls for those studies and about half the people are cases. Now we have, as best we can, depleted this resource of people known to have severe pediatric disease, so the types of Mendelian diseases that Gil talked about, as well as their first degree relatives. But of course some individuals in this cohort will still be ill or will go on to become ill later on through adult onset rare disorders. However, we think that the levels of severe disease within this population are probably broadly comparable to the general population as a whole. So this is a reasonable reference data set if you're interested in figuring out if a variant that is present in your rare disease patient is present in the general population, and if so, what frequency it has within that population. And I won't go into detail about some of the work we're doing here, but about 40% of the samples have some clinical data available. About a third of the samples have consent that is consistent with recontact. So for a subset of these individuals, we can actually go back. If we find interesting genotypes, we can actually go back and see what sorts of phenotypes they have, or at least get some limited information about their clinical status. So I'm showing this slide purely to indicate that this has been a project that has involved an enormous number of data donators, so principal investigators who have allowed their data to be used in this process. I think at last count, we're up to about 107 PIs who've signed an MOU that allows their data to be used in this project. So huge thanks to them and, of course, to our funders for making this possible. So this is one of the first things we did across the NOMAD dataset. It's a principal component analysis, basically just showing the first three principal components, which correspond, broadly speaking, to geographical ancestry across the NOMAD individuals. Here, we've generated this based on about just over 50,000 well-called single nucleotide variants. And we have inferred the population labels using a random forest approach with a set of about 40,000 people of so-called known ancestry. So what we can see in this plot is that we have a pretty diverse set of individuals who've been sequenced here, a big cloud of individuals of European ancestry. We have clusters corresponding to Finnish ancestry and Ashkenazi Jewish, big cloud up here of South Asian individuals, and we also have clusters corresponding to individuals of Latino ancestry, African and African American, as well as East Asian ancestry. So this is by no means a comprehensive sampling of human genetic diversity. In fact, we're not even close. We're missing, for instance, enormous swathes of diversity in Africa. The Middle East is missing, and this is because of the ascertainment biases that have gone into generating the samples that have gone into this data set. But what we do have is thousands of individuals for each of a set of relatively major continental groups. And this is really important if we want to be able to assign relatively confidently population frequency estimates for variants that we find in rare disease patients from those continents. And if you're interested in accessing the data, one of the key principles of EXAC and NOMAD, actually right from the very beginning, was that we wanted this to be a resource not just for us, but for anyone who wanted to look up variants on their patients. So you can go to nomad.broadinstitute.org. You can look up your favorite gene. I'm sure you guys all have a favorite gene. When you do, you will find these blue peaks that correspond to the coverage across the exomes, and the green line represents the coverage across the genomes, across the exons of that particular gene. Below that is a big long table of variants that tells you every variant that we have discovered within that gene across both the coding and the non-coding regions. And you can click on those to learn more about how common they are in the population and how confident we are that they're actually real, including for most variants actually a snapshot of the raw read support telling us that that variant is actually a genuine variant. You can also download a sites VCF that gives you a complete list of every variant that we've called, as well as its frequency across populations. And that's available for use in any setting without embargo or any restrictions whatsoever on use. So I wanted to talk about some of the scientific things that we can do once we have a collection of 135,000 exomes and genomes. One of the things that we spend a lot of time thinking about is ways that we can look at not just the variants that are present in this data set, but also the variants that are missing from the data set. And in that sense, I mean informatively missing from the data set. And so to do this, we worked very closely with Caitlin Samokar, a graduate student in Mark Daly's lab. She had developed a statistical model that allowed her to predict, actually with quite high confidence, given known mutation rates, how many variants of a particular functional class we should expect to see in each gene in the genome in a collection of 60,000 people or 135,000 people. And so this allows us to say, you can see in this plot here, for a variant type like synonymous variants, for instance, which are variants that are found within coding regions but don't change the amino acid sequence, how many synonymous variants we would expect to see in each gene. That's shown here on the x-axis under Caitlin's model. Each dot here is a gene. And on the y-axis, we have the number of variants of that type that were actually observed in the 60,000 people in XAC. And you can see that the fit for synonymous variants is extremely good, an R-squared of about 0.98. And so that tells us that this model is actually very well calibrated for variants that aren't subject to strong natural selection. But that relationship begins to break down, in fact, breaks down very severely as we start looking at variants that do actually have a functional impact on genes. So here we're focusing on genes that are what we call loss-of-function genes, that is, they're predicted to break the function of a protein-coding gene. And you can see here that the relationship here is far from linear. Almost all the genes in the genome have fewer loss-of-function variants than we would expect to see by chance, and this is not surprising at all. What it tells us is that for most genes in the genome, loss-of-function variants are bad, and so as a result, they tend to be removed from the population by natural selection. What's cool about this, though, is that with 60,000 people, and even more so with 135,000 people, we can actually say for many of the genes in the genome, how far below the line does that gene fall, and therefore how strong is the action of natural selection that's acting on loss-of-function variants in that particular gene. So that really gives us a measure about how critical that gene is and how bad it is when you break it. So just to give you two examples, this is a gene called DINK1H1, where we know exactly what happens when you break it. Heterozygous missense and loss-of-function variants in this gene result in some pretty nasty neurodevelopmental disorders, including seizure disorders and intellectual disability. Caitlin's model is very well calibrated for synonymous variants in this gene. The gene is missing about two-thirds of the missense variants and virtually all of the loss-of-function variants that we would expect to see by chance. We would expect to see 161. In fact, we only see four. And of those four, two of them are artifacts. One is a sequencing error, one is an annotation error. There are, in fact, two people who appear to be carrying loss-of-function variants in this gene. We don't have phenotype data about them, and in fact, they may actually suffer from these disorders. So that's where we know what happens when you break the gene. This is a gene where we don't know what happens in humans. This gene, UBR5, we know is involved in the ubiquitin pathway. We know if you knock it out in mice, it kills them during embryogenesis. But there's no known human loss-of-function phenotype. But it has a profile that's extremely similar to DINK1H1, telling us, actually, with very high confidence, that heterozygous loss-of-function mutations in this gene do something, probably something pretty nasty, probably resulting in some kind of relatively severe human disease phenotype. The fact that we don't know what that disease phenotype is yet could mean one of two things. We just haven't sequenced the right people yet. Or it could be that, in fact, this results in embryo loss. So heterozygous loss-of-function results in people dying before they can actually be born. So overall, we identify more than 3,000 genes with a near-complete loss of loss-of-function variants compared to expectations. We call these genes with a high probability of loss-of-function intolerance, or high PLI. And that includes almost all of the known genes where knocking out a single copy is enough to cause disease. But importantly, more than 70% of these genes, we have no idea what they do. There's no associated human phenotype. In fact, for most of them, we don't know what the molecular function is. And so we now prioritize these genes extraordinarily heavily when we start looking at disease phenotypes. And this has already proven extremely useful in narrowing down on genes in autism, schizophrenia, and a whole range of other very nasty pediatric diseases. So the last thing I wanted to talk about was an example of how we can use these large cohorts to understand the precise impact of individual variants within a gene on disease risk. And this is work that's been led by Eric Minichel. This was a very personal project for reasons I'll describe in a minute. Happened while Eric Minichel was an analyst in my lab. So Eric came to my lab extremely motivated to work on a gene called PRNP, which encodes the prion protein. And his motivation for this was his wife, Sonia, who's shown here. Sonia's shown with her mother. This photo was taken at the beginning of 2010 when Sonia's mother was completely healthy. Over the course of that year, she underwent a pretty terrifying cognitive decline, went into frank dementia, and awfully passed away at the end of that year. So it was about a 9-month period between the onset of symptoms and her dying. At the time that she died, it was completely unclear what had actually killed her. But on autopsy, it was found that her brain was full of accumulations of a particular protein called prion protein. This is, in some cases, a genetic disease, so her prion protein gene was sequenced. She was found to carry a mutation that was known to cause, in a dominant way, a very severe prion disease called fatal familial insomnia. So Sonia had a 50% chance of actually carrying that same mutation. She then was faced with the choice of whether or not she wanted to be tested herself. Her mother had died in her 50s. She was at the time in her early 30s. She and Eric thought about it and then decided to go ahead and get tested. And in early 2011, Sonia learned that she too carries the same variant that killed her mother. So as far as we know, everyone who carries this particular variant has a 100% chance of going on to die from prion disease. There's many ways of responding to this kind of incredibly catastrophic information. Eric and Sonia responded in a way that I still to this day find inspiring. They quit their jobs. Eric at the time was a town planner. Sonia was a lawyer, a Harvard-trained lawyer. So they abandoned their respective careers and retrained completely as biomedical scientists, initially with Sonia training in the wet lab and Eric focusing on bioinformatics work, and that's what they continue doing to this day, as I'll show you later. So when Eric came to my lab, what he wanted to know more than anything was an answer to this question. Given that Sonia carries this particular mutation, how likely is it that she will go on to get prion disease? And this turns out to be a little bit uncertain. This is a question of what we call penetrance, that is the probability that a carrier of a particular disease genotype will actually go on to manifest that disease. This is known to be incomplete and variable for many disease-causing mutations. So in BRCA1, for instance, we know that women who have protein truncating variants in this gene will go on to have a somewhere between a 60 to 80% chance of contracting breast cancer, but that has a big error bars associated with it, and not every woman who has a BRCA1 mutation will go on to die from breast cancer. And in fact, for most disease-causing variants, even ones that are relatively well-established, we don't actually have a good quantitative estimate of what that penetrance is. That's also true for prion disease. So prion diseases we know are relatively rare, lifetime risk of about 1 in 5,000. 85% of the cases, we have no idea what causes them. They appear to be sporadic. But as I mentioned, 15% of these cases are genetic, and notorious 1% of prion disease cases are acquired, and they can be acquired through ingestion of contaminated meat, for instance, as was the case for the variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease outbreak in the UK, which is caused by mad cow disease beef. The genetic cases are due to a set of over 60 known dominant gain-of-function mutations in the gene. And what's amazing about this disease is that we have incredibly good surveillance data. Basically, everyone who is diagnosed with prion disease gets reported to a surveillance center. And for most of those individuals, the prion disease gene, gene is sequenced. And so we have an almost complete collection of genetic information from diagnosed prion disease cases across the Western world. And so what Eric set about doing was collecting a set of information that would allow us to compare the frequency of these mutations in prion disease cases versus controls. So we started with a set of population controls, and here we reasoned that completely penetrant versions in aggregate for a dominant disease should be no more common in the population than the disease that they cause. So that means that we can run analyses even in a set of samples like EXAC, where we don't know exactly whether people will go on to get prion disease, but we can assume relatively confidently that the frequency of prion disease-causing mutations in that population will be no higher than the actual frequency of prion disease itself. So we collected our 60,000 EXAC exomes, all of whom had effectively perfect coverage for the prion gene. We were also able to work with 23andMe to bring in information from about 500,000 of their customers, all of whom had been genotyped for 16 reportedly disease-causing SNPs within that gene. And then in a series of feats of pretty remarkable political jujitsu, Eric was able to collect over 10,500 cases of prion disease who had the PRNP gene sequenced. This constitutes pretty much every known or probable prion disease case that has appeared in the US, Europe, Australia, and Japan for the last 15 to 20 years. It's the biggest collection of rare disease cases that I have ever worked with, and probably the biggest collection of cases we'll ever get for something like prion disease. So this is a really remarkable data set to do a comparison on. And so we can calculate pretty easily how many individuals we would expect to see in our 60,000 EXAC individuals who actually do have real variants that will cause prion disease. And if you multiply these slightly hand-wavy numbers out, you end up with a number that is somewhere between 1 and 2 individuals who carry a mutation that will go on to kill them of prion disease. So that's the expected number. The actual observed number turns out to be much higher. So we found 16 different mutations, I think it's 12 different mutations in PRNP that had previously been reported to be pathogenic, and 52 individuals carried them. So that's 30 times higher than what we would expect to see given the frequency of the disease in the population. There's multiple possible explanations here. It could be that prion disease is actually terrifyingly more common than we think it is. We're pretty confident that's not the case. So by far the most likely explanation is that some of these previously reported disease-causing mutations actually don't cause disease in everyone, or perhaps in some cases don't cause disease in anyone. They've been falsely reported as being pathogenic. So to explore that, we generated a plot that looks like this, and as well as did a bunch of statistical analyses that I'm not going to go through here. This plot is very simple. Basically, what it shows on the x-axis is the number of times we observed a particular reported prion disease-causing mutation in our cases. So that basically tells us how common it is in patients who went on to get the disease. And on the y-axis, we have the frequency of the same variants in EXAC. Again, a set of population controls broadly representative of the general population. And the variants then fall out into three broad categories. On the x-axis, we have variants that are seen in cases, but are seen never or very rarely in controls. These four variants along this axis all turn out to be variants with incredibly strong evidence for actually being pathogenic and disease-causing. And as far as we can tell, every individual who has ever carried these variants has indeed gone on to die from prion disease if they survive into their 50s. And unfortunately, that does include D178N, which is the variant that Sonia carries. On the y-axis, we have a set of variants that are at relatively low frequency in cases. They're also at relatively low frequency, basically the same frequency in controls. So we have there's no information here whatsoever to indicate that these variants are actually associated with prion disease. And in fact, certainly for these variants that cluster up here, we can very confidently rule them out as having any effect whatsoever on prion disease risk at all. So these are variants that have accidentally been associated with prion disease because they happen to be in an individual who died from sporadic prion disease, and as a result, they ended up in the databases, and we can now, in most cases, throw those away. And then there's a set of variants, really interesting variants in the middle, who are too common in cases to be completely benign, but also too common in controls to be fully pathogenic. And these are variants that clearly are a product of incomplete penetrance, that is, they cause diseases in some people but not in others. We can calculate with some confidence the actual absolute lifetime risk of prion disease for people who carry each of these mutations, and that ranges enormously from 1 in 1,000 risk for this variant up here, but still confidently above zero, and down to about 10% risk for this variant down here. That has profound implications for genetic counseling. For all three of these variants, there was information in the literature that suggested that there was incomplete penetrance, but we had no idea what these risk estimates actually were. And now people who are working with families affected by these mutations can go back and give them a relatively well-calibrated estimate of how likely it is that another family member who carries those mutations will go on to get the disease. Just to give an example about how this information can change lives, there was an opinion piece that accompanied the publication of this prion disease work early last year. And in that, Robert Green, a clinician at Brigham and Women's, describes a patient that he was seeing at the time. This patient's mother had died, like Sonia's mother, had died of prion disease. It was unknown what the cause was. This patient had her prion gene sequenced and was found to carry a mutation called E196A, and she had been told as a result that it was very likely she would go on to die from prion disease in her 50s. It turns out that E196A is the mutation for which we are by far the most confident that this has absolutely no association with prion disease. This is a completely accidental finding in this woman. Robert was able to return that data back to her. He was also able to say that, looking back through the literature, there is no information on segregation of this variant within prion disease families. There's no family history in patients who carry that particular variant, and the frequency is absolutely no higher in cases than it is in controls. So her probability of going on to get prion disease is no higher than the population average. So basically, Robert was able to commute a death sentence in this particular case, and that, of course, can have transformative impacts in other ways as well. So this information did not change, as far as we know, Sonia's risk of going on to get prion disease. But I think it did, in many ways, reestablish Eric and Sonia's commitment to working as hard as they can to come up with a therapeutic approach to reducing the levels of prion protein in Sonia's brain to the level that it's actually possible to ameliorate her risk of going on to get prion disease. In this case, the therapeutic target is actually extremely clear. If it's possible to get a chemical agent into Sonia's brain that reduces the overall levels of native prion protein, it's almost certain that she will be able to reduce that risk. And Eric and Sonia are now working at a lab at the Broad Institute. They're PhD students at Harvard, but amazingly have their own lab at the Broad Institute. They're working in collaboration with a number of industry partners to produce compounds that will hopefully be able to produce exactly that effect over the next 10 to 15 years, which is the time that Sonia has left to come up with such a therapy. And of course, we all wish them the best in that quest. So we have a lot of work to do to be able to expand NOMAD to be able to answer similar questions for a whole range of other disease genes. We're very interested in continuing to expand this. We will be expanding this to over 65,000 whole human genomes with a new call set that will hopefully be generated later this year, calling structural variants across the entire data set, and a set of analyses focused on protein truncating variants, as well as looking at constraint in non-coding regions. And I think the key points that it's worth emphasizing in the context of this presentation is, firstly, that naturally occurring human genetic variation is really useful for understanding both the impact of variation in a disease setting, but also in terms of understanding human biology, that the more humans we have sequenced and phenotyped, and the more diverse their ancestry, the better off we are in terms of understanding this disease risk. That everyone carries rare genetic variants. It is true that most interesting variants are rare, but it's also importantly true that most rare variants are not actually particularly interesting, and these large-scale reference databases help to distinguish between those two scenarios. And finally, one of the things that I think has been a real strength of X-ACK and NOMAD has been we've been very fortunate to benefit from a human genomics community that's been willing to share data openly and rapidly, but there's still a lot of work that we as a community can do to make that process better, and it's really only with that open and rapid data sharing that we can build resources like this and make them available to the world. So with that, I'll finish by thanking everyone who's been involved in generating and analyzing this important resource, again, including the analysis team, production team at Broad, the individuals who built the Nomad website, and once again, the genomics platform and the Hale team for all of the critical work in building this data out. Thanks to you guys for listening.